Scientists are still trying to understand the coronavirus outbreak. In China, where it all began, cities are really feeling the impact.
Please wear a mask if you go out. Once you get home, make sure you wash your hands.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, in northern Syria, a cry for help from civilians besieged by war.
We ask the international community to interfere so soon, please.
An English teacher in Idlib, where Syrian government forces are closing in. And the Church of England apologizes for its racism.
The church should be speaking prophetically for justice for all people, regardless of the color of their skin.
And from the home of the discotheque, Beats for Climate Change.
The sound was really surprised a lot of people.
The stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us today. More numbers from China on the coronavirus outbreak, and they are not good. Officials in Hubei province in central China, where the outbreak began, are using a broader definition to diagnose people with COVID-19. That's the disease caused by the coronavirus. The new definition brings the estimated number of infected people in China up to nearly 60,000. The death toll there, more than 1,300. Those numbers have residents across China constantly looking out for the latest updates.
People are checking in on their phone, checking the numbers, checking to see if there are any cases nearby them. There's a lot of data available.
Correspondent Rebecca Canther is a longtime resident of Shanghai.
Today, people in Shanghai and around China could see a pretty crazy spike in number of confirmed cases that looked almost like a, not vertical, but a very upward-leaning trend, which was worrying.
So why is there this spike?
They've changed the metrics in how they define a confirmed case. So previously, they had to go through several tests. Now, they're using a much broader metric. So they're using CT lung scans as a way to confirm cases earlier. A doctor who's working on the front lines said this can actually speed up getting people who need the help, getting them the help they need faster. This doctor was seeing it as a very positive trend that more people could get the treatment they need faster.
Right. So the kind of sober view of this is that this is a good thing. But I'm just wondering, for people who see these graphs popping up on their phones and seeing this spike, the change in the metrics, is it reassuring for people because they think the information is more useful about the virus's spread, or is it led to more frustration and anger?
It's definitely seen as more useful because people are saying, OK, they're finding new ways to sort of measure this. But the problem is that now we can't really compare last week with this week because there's a new metric. So
right.
Some doctors are calling it like a moving target. So it's hard to measure now.
So what have you been hearing about what people are doing in response to today's uptick in cases? I understand this week was supposed to mark a return to work after the Chinese New Year. Is that happening?
Yes, people are returning to work, but they are mostly returning to work remotely. So that means a lot of people are sitting at their home office or anywhere that they can work in their home. People are not going out. You don't see very many people on the street. And so they're working from home. And if you are like me, someone with kids, their kids are also off of school. It's very difficult because you're trying to get your work done and also take care of your kids at the same time. So it's kind of a mess.
Shanghai is a megacity, the second most populous in China. I mean, what does it look like right now? Is it quiet?
It is quiet. It is quiet. I did note today was the first time that I heard the sound of, you know, a sports car zoom by, which is something that I hear more often in regular times in Shanghai. So that was the first time I'd heard that in a long time. There's not a lot of people on the street, except for people cleaning the street and disinfecting.
I don't know if you've gone out at all, but do you know what the atmosphere is in stores or bars and cafes?
When you go to a food market, there's definitely people buying food there. Everyone needs to eat. But when you try to go to a cafe or a restaurant, since maybe 2 days ago, there's been new rules that no one can sit in a restaurant or a cafe. So you can go, you can buy something, you can take it away, but you cannot sit inside. So restaurants are moving their chairs away or taking all their chairs away because they don't want people to stay in there.
Wow. So it's all like takeout service now.
Yeah. Today I was going to meet a colleague for lunch and we had nowhere to go, so we just went for a walk instead.
Now, Rebecca, you recorded a scene outside a housing complex near your home. Sounds like somebody on a bullhorn. What are they saying?
That's at a housing compound near my home. And it's the recording over and over and over again that just says, please wear a mask if you go out. Once you get home, make sure you wash your hands. Please go out very infrequently. And if you're coming back from outside of Shanghai, you need to report your arrival immediately.
You were saying earlier, Rebecca, that people are trying to figure out if there are cases nearby them. Is there any data that relates to parts of the city or neighborhoods?
Yes. Every day they're posting, so you can see where the nearest cases are. So I can see that the nearest case I checked earlier today, the nearest case was like a kilometer away from me. Or you can see which district, which part of the city, which area. Is it a housing area or is it a business area? So yes, you can see all that information. And I can stay away from the places where I know that there's been a reported case.
Well, good luck moving forward. Correspondent Rebecca Canther, a longtime resident of Shanghai, speaking with us from Shanghai. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
The first case of COVID-19 in London was confirmed today. At least 9 people have tested positive for the disease in the UK so far. And that got us wondering, how are other countries preparing? Bernice Langdon is a primary care doctor in southwest London. What drew our attention to her is something that she wrote for a British newspaper about interacting with patients with respiratory symptoms. Dr. Langdon reflected on her own reaction when she met a patient who had a cough and a sore throat, who also happened to be Asian.
When I saw her, the guidelines came flooding into my mind, and I thought coronavirus. And it is a tense moment. But the next difficult thing was that I had to then approach the question of whether she was Chinese or not, which seemed a bit unfair to start making assumptions about where people are from and asking questions about it. When you read the guidelines, you're like, yeah, no, we need to look out for people from Wuhan. But when it actually happens and someone walks in and you have to say, are you Chinese? Were you from Wuhan? I think it feels a bit unfair. So that was the first thing I had to do, was to brace myself for that question.
How did you deal with the situation?
So in a kind of an apologetic way, I hope you don't mind me asking kind of thing. Mm. And people are quite understanding because everybody knows what's going on. So she was quite accepting of it and reassured me.
We should say she was sick, but after you did your diagnostics, you concluded she did not have COVID-19, right?
So the key thing was the travel history. So she had many people, of course, with a temperature and a cough. But the key difference here is the travel history. If someone did have a travel history, then I would be looking out for the coronavirus symptoms that the Chinese doctors have been telling us about.
What are you supposed to do when you have a patient that you suspect may have COVID-19? You talked about guidelines.
Yes, the guidelines really surprised me. If the patient had been in contact with Wuhan, I have to just simply leave the room. And that's another very strange and unusual piece of advice, because normally doctors are expected to be brave and to get on with examining. That's one of the key things, really, and not to leave the room. But this advice is different from all the advice I've ever had before. So, yes, I would be expected to leave and shut the door.
And that advice comes from the British government?
So that advice comes from the British government, and they've been in touch with every GP in the country, and they're very clear in the guidelines. The point is to isolate and not to spread it. And I think that gives us all time. If we can delay the virus coming to the country, it gives us time to get strategies like testing and vaccines and things. So I think that's the idea behind it. I'm sure it will come. I'm sure it will be mild for most people. And personally,
sorry, you're sure there will be an outbreak in the UK? Is that what you're saying? Are you sure that the guidance will?
Yeah, I think it will come through. That would be my guess. Although we're trying to delay it as long as possible.
I mean, the guidelines are a little confusing, because what happens to the patient if the doctor walks out of the room? And I mean, how does the patient actually leave the building at that point?
I have trouble visualizing that as well. So the real goal is, or the ideal is, for patients not to present to general practice at all, that they should telephone first. And if they do come to the practice, the receptionists are there at the front, and we want them to send them straight home. But if they did then come in and the first you heard of it was taking history, the idea is to then leave the room, shut the door, and continue the consultation by telephone.
Right. I mean, those are the guidelines. I mean, it does seem to make sense if you just read the paper, but I mean, with all the warnings not to be panicky about this, it must have given you some pause.
Yes, I thought, when I wrote that article, I felt I had grown up and was not so panicky that I would, you know, people do die of viruses, and it's a normal thing to die. And but when I then came in contact with my second a second person who I really thought might have it, all of those high ideals flew out of the window, and I was, you know, it's a very tense moment. But I mean, part of the point of training is to stay calm and not to convey that fear, and to sit tight and figure out what's going on. And again, the travel history didn't fit, so it was a false alarm.
Dr. Bernice Langdon, a primary care physician in Southwest London. She's also the author of the book, Learning Microbiology Through Clinical Consultation. Dr. Langdon, thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Last week on The World, we told you about a smartphone app that some overseas and U.S. military voters will be using to cast ballots in the 2020 election. We've got an update. Researchers at MIT published a report today that said the voting app is riddled with serious security flaws, flaws that could even allow hackers to change or eliminate votes. The World's Lydia Emanuelito has been covering this story, and she's in the studio with me. Remind us what this app is, Lydia, and who gets to use it.
Yeah, this is an app that was created by a company that's based here in Boston. It's called Votes. That's V-O-A-T-Z. They've been around for a few years now, but this is the first time their app is going to be used in a presidential election. So counties in several states, including Utah, Oregon, Washington, signed up to let some voters use this app, the Votes app, to cast ballots in the primaries and the presidential election. And the goal here is to make voting more accessible for citizens living overseas, for military members based abroad, and in some cases for people with disabilities. But election security experts have been saying for a while that they have some serious concerns about internet voting broadly. They say it introduces unnecessary risks to a system that we already know is vulnerable, as we saw in 2016. And the report out today by MIT shows some serious security flaws with the Votes app in particular.
What exactly?
So what MIT researchers found was that hackers could do things like stop people from voting while they're using the app. They could change, you know, when you're looking at your phone and trying to cast your ballot, a hacker could change what you're looking at. And they could even change the votes that people cast using the app without the voter even knowing. Daniel Weitzner is the director of the MIT Internet Policy Research Initiative, and he was one of the researchers on the report.
The vulnerabilities that we've shown are real attacks that can be mounted certainly by nation-state adversaries and most likely by even less capable adversaries.
That's pretty worrying. What does Vote say about this?
Vote says that this report was done in bad faith, that the MIT researchers reviewed an old version of the app, and that the methodology was flawed because these MIT researchers didn't have access to the full system. Now, we should note that the reason why MIT researchers didn't have access to the full system is because Votes wouldn't give them access. Mm. This is actually one of the reasons why Votes has been so widely criticized by the election security community, is because people say the company hasn't been transparent. Researchers have been asking Votes to share its source code, to share a detailed technical description of its app, but they haven't done that. And they say there are proprietary reasons for that. Instead, what they've done is they've had third-party security firms do audits of their app, but none of the reports that have come out of those have been published. And so this is significant. This MIT report is significant because it's the first time we're seeing publicly an independent security analysis of Votes.
There is a lot more to the story that we couldn't get to. You can follow the rest of our coverage on our website, theworld.org. The World's Lydia Manolito, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
A French mayor defends his town from climate change. That's coming up next. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Remember when Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Governator, defined a leader who cared about climate change? He even played it for yucks on The Tonight Show.
Hi. I'm on a show tonight.
Sir, Arnold Schwarzenegger is on the show tonight? And Arnold Schwarzenegger would not drive a Prius.
I'll be back.
Today, though, who's the greenest world leader? If you ask French President Emmanuel Macron, his answer would probably be, c'est moi. He talks about the environment all the time. He's rolled out some new environmental policies. Macron's even getting a brand new, fully armored hybrid vehicle. Today, the French president visited a spot called the Sea of Ice. It's a glacier on the top of Mont Blanc, Western Europe's highest mountain, and it's under threat. Jean-Marc Payex is the mayor of the town of Saint-Gervais at the foot of Mont Blanc. He's going to speak with us through his interpreter, Claire Correa. Mr. Mayor, thanks very much for being with us today. You just met with President Macron. You were talking about protecting Mont Blanc. How did that go?
There's no reglementation, no rule today that would stop people that want to walk to the summit with a ridiculous amount of material or equipment. For example, one gentleman last year that climbed the summit with a rowing machine.
Right, Matthew Disney.
President Macron has now introduced this reglementation so that we can only do mountaineering or skiing in this part of the Mont Blanc range.
Mr. Mayor, I understand that you wrote a letter to President Macron asking him to protect the mountain. You wrote, Mr. President, taking care of the forests and the Amazon is very good. Ignoring what is happening on Mont Blanc and letting disrespect continue is not tolerable. When you sent this letter to President Macron, did you think at the time his policies were green enough? And do you think they are now?
So it wasn't sufficient until now. Instead of it just being all talk, he actually came today to move towards change and has promised changes for the environment.
So you got exactly what you wanted.
Yep, obviously. Huh? See, it's 17 years he's been fighting for this since 2003.
Jean-Marc Payex, the mayor of the French town of Saint-Gervais, near a melting Mont Blanc, the largest mountain in Western Europe. Mayor Payex has been speaking with us through his interpreter, Claire Correa. Mr. Mayor, thank you very much. Merci à vous. And thank you Merci. Very much, Claire.
Thank you.
Merci.
If you were watching the Super Bowl earlier this month on Fox, you may have seen two people performing the national anthem. Singer Demi Lovato and also Christine's son, Kim, who signed the national anthem. Kim is a deaf Asian-American artist who lives in Berlin. She's traveling the globe sharing her art, which explores what the world is like for people who cannot hear. The World's Lucy Martirosian has our story.
Christine Sun Kim was born in California in 1980. She's deaf with a capital D, meaning she's part of deaf culture, a culture that carries a set of things like social beliefs and values that are influenced by deafness and sign language. Kim sports delicate, round glasses, and she has straight, black, blunt bangs across her forehead. She's friendly with a deadpan sense of humor that matches her drawings. So it's not lost on me that I'm interviewing someone for radio, and this someone is communicating to me not with their voice, but with their hands. Kim spoke to me through an American Sign Language interpreter. She considers herself privileged to have grown up in the U.S. with American Sign Language, or ASL.
At that time in the 80s, it seemed acceptable to learn sign language. It was like a shift. There was a shift prior to that where parents were encouraged to, you know, oralism was the way to go.
Oralism meaning teaching deaf children to learn to lip read or mimic speech and vocal patterns. And by the way, ASL has nothing to do with English. It's even different than British Sign Language. And in Germany, where Kim is based now, there's its own sign language there. In total, there are some 300 distinct sign languages around the world. In many countries, though, there remains a stigma that if deaf and hard of hearing children learn to sign, they won't integrate properly into society. But Kim says she doesn't buy this. Again, here's her interpreter.
I truly believe American Sign Language is important because from the beginning, when a child is born, if they learn ASL, they have full access to information.
But still, in the United States, 72% of families don't sign with their deaf children, and that's according to the organization, the Communication Service for the Deaf. Kim was lucky because her immigrant parents from South Korea took up both English and ASL to communicate with their daughters.
My sister is also deaf, so they had two good reasons to learn sign language. So I feel very fortunate, very lucky that I was the right place at the right time.
In the 90s, there was the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, and that really supported deaf and hard of hearing people because it gave them things like closed captioning and interpreters at school. And that made the U.S. one of the most progressive places for deaf and hard of hearing people. But Kim says it's not perfect. There's still a long way to go before the act is completely accessible and inclusive. She still considers herself fortunate to have been raised in the United States and now live in Germany. The World Health Organization says in many developing countries, deaf or hard of hearing children don't receive any schooling. So Kim's been touring the world with her art, and right now she's set up at MIT just outside of Boston. Besides drawings, Kim uses a lot of sound in her work. And if you're wondering how, even though Kim can't hear, she picks up on visual cues about sound. She uses other people as her guide. So, for example, when she's eating a bag of potato chips, she says she can tell she's being noisy by the way people look at her. Or when a glass shatters and everybody's heads turn, she knows there's a problem. Growing up, Kim says she'd always felt sound was a hearing person's thing, but now it's a big part of her artistic platform.
If I hadn't used sound, if I still kept discussing those topics but using a different medium, I don't think I would have gotten the attention I did.
She didn't let me record her sound installation, but basically you hear a low-frequency xylophone, very basic sounds, no lyrics. As an artist, she expresses a lot of what she calls her deaf rage through charcoal diagrams. Her series, Off the Charts, is about her personal decisions as a deaf person. She expresses them through pie charts.
And I always find that the best way to communicate with a wider audience who are not deaf is to use a format that people can easily understand. It's like mathematical angles, how much amount of rage I have. You can see it in the size of the angle.
There were hundreds of people at the opening night at MIT, including college student Rebecca Brunson.
I really love what I've seen so far. My favorite one so far is the hearing people say to me. It's always important, I feel, to educate yourself about communities that you're not a part of.
But some people were confused by the exhibit, like student Joseph Nardi.
It's very strange to me because it's just, I don't understand it.
Henriette Holdish is the curator of Kim's exhibit. She says the drawings are meant to be profound and funny.
But funny in a way that there's a certain amount of absurdity in expressing a very personal decision in a diagrammatic pie chart form. But I think also there's something that people can really learn about some of the decisions that deaf people make about how they deal with language and to what extent they want to engage with spoken language.
Today, Kim's artwork has been displayed in museums in Asia, North America, and Europe. She sees herself as an archivist.
Often hearing people are the one who are looking and creating history, and we are just kind of pushed to the side. I've made work, I've put it in history, and as that continues to grow, hopefully so does the awareness.
Kim hopes people take away greater appreciation for both sign language and sound. For The World, I'm Lucy Martirosian.
You can find photos of Christine Sun Kim's artwork on our website, theworld.org. You're with The World. A U.S. ban on immigration from Nigeria went into effect this month, separating a man in Texas from his wife.
It is heartbreaking as well for her. You know, as much as I feel heartbroken, she does feel that way. I mean, there's nothing more important for newlyweds than to be together.
I'm Marco Werman, the personal side of federal immigration policy. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. The scene in Idlib province in northwestern Syria is terrifying. More than 800,000 people there have fled their homes in recent weeks. Military forces aligned with Syria on one side and Turkey on the other are fighting for control over the territory. Idlib is the last rebel-held province in Syria. According to the UN, this is the largest displacement of people in the 9 years of civil war there. People have fled toward the border with Turkey, but that border is closed. Turkey's government says it has already taken in more than 3 million Syrian refugees. So right now, many displaced people are stuck in tent camps near the border, dealing with freezing temperatures. Riyath Al-Sheikh teaches English at Idlib University. He told me what made him flee his town of Ariha, 12 miles south of Idlib.
About 10 days ago, Ariha was subjected to a heavy shelling and bombing from war planes and shelling from the land. And about more than 50 people died and many buildings were destroyed. So we decided to leave the area because it was no longer safe for us to stay there.
How difficult was the evacuation? Was there fighting going on as you were leaving Idlib?
The majority of the people decided to go around the Turkish border, and even me, myself, I went there. But I found it very, very cold, and I was scared from the situation and the suffering around the Turkish border because a big number of people living there under tents and in the cold. So I was scared that my small children might die out of cold. So I decided to go back to live in Idlib, though it's only about 7 kilometers from the regime forces.
So you fled Arriha to the border, felt insecure there, and then went back to Idlib. As you said, you've got several children, four kids, ages 5 to 16. How are they doing?
My situation is much more bitter than the majority of the people who left the city and who are living in the open. The human situation in Idlib is very difficult indeed. There is a lack of the food items, and the people are suffering from the cold. But what's most dangerous of all is that the people are very frightened and very afraid that the regime forces, which are very near here, might decide to enter the city. If this happened, there would be a real massacre and a genocide. So we are waiting.
Well, you did describe those tent camps near the Turkish border. What's happening there? What have you heard? Do the evacuees in those tent camps know where they are going to settle?
They don't know where to go. Every day we have a big number of people moving there. You know that the human organizations are not able to provide enough tents to those people who now, there are a lot of people living in the cold. And even today, there is a news arriving that 9 children died due to the cold.
You and your family, hundreds of thousands of other Syrians, are caught in the middle of a territorial struggle between the two large armies of Turkey and Syria. What gives you hope that this is all going to end eventually?
Now, people in general, though the suffering, though the big suffering, we have started to feel a bit more comfortable since the Turkish army started to cross the borders, and we felt a bit safer. But until now, nothing real has taken place on the ground. Only today, Idlib city received 2 air raids, and I don't know how many people died from these raids. All the people who have fled, who have escaped from the regime forces, pray and hope that Turkey might be supported from even Europe. In fact, we ask the international community to interfere so soon, please. We don't know when the regime might take a decision to enter the city of Idlib. We don't know where to go.
Riyath, I'd like us to hear something that you actually recorded 10 days ago as you were leaving your home in Arriha. This is one of your children.
Yeah, Jamal.
Riyath, was that your son?
In fact, this is my son, Yazan, the youngest one of my children. So he was crying because he was saying farewell to the house. In fact, all of us cried, indeed. It was very, I'm sorry.
Riyath, I'm just wondering about your children, and when you think about the future your children will inherit, what occurs to you?
Well, actually, this is more difficult, but now we are only thinking about whether we might stay alive or not. So we stop thinking about the future or the future of my sons. All the schools have stopped, you know. Nothing is taking place. But now the people are not thinking about this. They are thinking about whether the regime forces moved or advanced towards Idlib. Where to go? This is the most important thing which we are thinking about now.
Riyath Al-Sheikh teaches English at Idlib University. Riyath, thank you. Really appreciate it, and stay safe. We're thinking of you.
Thank you very much, Andy. Thank you very much.
The Trump administration has expanded its travel ban to 6 more countries. One of them is Nigeria, the largest economy in Africa. Students and travelers from Nigeria are still eligible for visas and are welcome to visit the U.S., but any Nigerians hoping to emigrate to this country are being denied visas. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval has more on how the sizable Nigerian community in Texas is dealing with these new rules.
Saheed says he can't wait to begin his new life as a married man. He shows me a video from the day he popped the question.
And then she saw me, she was so surprised. She never expected it because, you know, we talked like a day before then. And while I was on my flight, I was texting her because I was able to connect to in-flight Wi-Fi.
Saheed asked me not to use his last name because he's afraid it could hurt his wife's immigration case. He's 32, a U.S. citizen, and has lived almost half his life in this country. He met his wife, Azizat, through family back in Nigeria.
She's a neighbor of my aunt in Nigeria.
Azizat is a doctor. Saheed is a pharmacist. They hit it off instantly, Saheed says.
It's just a friendship that, you know, blossomed into love and led to marriage.
They got married a year ago and applied for Azizat's visa to join Saheed in the U.S. Their paperwork was in order. All they had to do was wait.
It is heartbreaking as well for her. Just, you know, as much as I feel heartbroken, she does feel that way. Because, I mean, there's nothing more important for newlyweds than to be together.
Many Nigerians were in shock when the U.S. added Nigeria to the list of 13 countries facing a travel ban.
We were somewhat blindsided with the announcement of the visa restrictions by the U.S.
That's Nigerian Foreign Minister Jeffrey Onyema at a news conference with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Here's Pompeo explaining the new policy.
President Trump announced the suspension of immigrant visas for Nigerians because Nigeria has room to grow in sharing important national security information. I'm optimistic that's going to happen.
Pompeo's comments offer some hope, says Houston area immigration attorney Busayo Fasidi. But even so, she says many Nigerians are right to worry the ban will keep them from being reunited with their family.
Most of my clients are trying to bring in their family members from overseas. Those ones that are trying to bring in their family members will be gravely impacted.
She says she's been bombarded with phone calls and messages about the ban.
A lot of people file for their elderly parents, then also spouses and children.
Fasidi says she was shocked when she heard about the ban, but also thinks the Nigerian government is partially to blame.
I think I'm going to lean towards the side of the U.S. government on that point, you know, surprisingly.
Fasidi says she doesn't see this particular policy as discriminatory. She says Nigeria should improve its security measures. Nigerian elder and Texas Southern University professor Chris Ulasi has his doubts.
I don't buy the reasoning. A countries don't normally ban or place undue restrictions on the countries that they have good relationship with.
Nigeria is one of the United States' top trading partners in Africa, exporting millions of barrels of oil each month. Nearly 300,000 Nigerians live in the U.S., and Julia Gillette with the Migration Policy Institute says a lot of them are quite successful.
They have pretty high rates of educational attainment. They're more likely to have a bachelor's degree or a graduate degree than U.S.-born people.
She says the Trump administration could be justified in its reasoning for the visa ban, but there's good reason to be skeptical.
What's interesting about this version is that it doesn't block those temporary visas for tourists or business travelers or students or temporary workers. And what that suggests is that the government doesn't see an imminent travel threat from any of these countries.
Gillette says blocking permanent visas seems like a way the U.S. government can pressure other countries to change their policies because these visitors pose no immediate threat. While Nigeria and the United States negotiate, thousands of people's lives are on pause. People like Azizat, who is studying to one day validate her medical degree in the U.S., and Saheed, who is saving up for a house where he hopes they'll someday live together. For The World, I'm Elizabeth Troval in Houston.
The Church of England is trying to come to terms with racism. The Archbishop of Canterbury, the leader of the church, was not pulling any punches. Justin Welby said he was ashamed and called the church, quote, deeply institutionally racist. So this week, officials with the Church of England approved a motion to formally apologize for discrimination against the Windrush generation. That's the name given to people who relocated to the UK from Caribbean countries after World War II. Father Andrew Morton Mumby put forward that motion to apologize.
The best form of apology is changed behavior. And I think that is the spirit in which the Archbishop of Canterbury made his apology. I think there's a real sense that his apology is one which will lead to change, and that's the spirit in which it's offered.
Do you see this racism impacting members of your own church community?
I do, yes. And in my congregation, I have black people who have had their homes raided by the UK Borders Agency. They've been arrested in front of their children and taken away to detention centres, only to eventually be released. Now, that is no humane way to treat people. And you look at the people who are being detained and you think this is because of the colour of their skin.
We have to represent the people of the Windrush generation as well. I mean, what did they face after coming to the UK over the years? And what racist treatment did they face at the Church of England?
There are lots and lots of examples, but the one that I've chosen to focus on is one which affects the parish where I serve directly, St. Peter's Walworth in South London. It was in 1961 that Doreen Brown's sister Muriel and her parents and their siblings came along with a white neighbour who said to them, "Look, let me take you along to the local parish church." When they arrived at the steps of the church on Sunday morning, the then priest literally stood at the top of the steps. And as Muriel has said, he said, I'm going to have to ask the congregation about this. And he would not let them enter the church. And, you know, Doreen and Muriel have told me how their mother was absolutely fuming about this. But what could she do? There is a priest who, as Muriel said to me, should have been welcoming people into God's house, not his church, but God's church. And yet he didn't even let them enter the building. Anecdotally, we know that that happened to a lot of people from the Windrush generation.
There is an acronym that is used in the UK, BAME. It's B-A-M-E, stands for Black, yes, Asian, and Minority Ethnic. I've, yes, seen numbers suggesting that the number of Church of England priests from a BAME background has been growing recently, doubling to 8% between 2016 and 2018. Are things in the church changing, or does that number not tell the whole story?
I think the answer is both and, because things are changing. I've been part of a group which has tried to work to increase minority ethnic vocations to ordained ministry in the Church of England, recognizing that for many people there have been all sorts of barriers. It has been true, and in some ways still is true, that clergy and others select people after our own image. We select people like us for jobs and roles in the church, including encouraging people to explore a vocation to ordained ministry. So it's a mixed picture.
I'm just curious, what is the relationship of the Church of England to the British government? I mean, is your apology kind of a stand-in for British government policy?
The Church of England is the established church here in England, and so there is a relationship with the UK government. Some of our senior bishops sit in the House of Lords, but equally we're a completely independent religious body. So the church cannot speak for the government. And in fact, what I am saying in my motion is that the church should actually be challenging the government. The church should be speaking prophetically for justice for all people, regardless of the colour of their skin, in our nation today. So in some ways, I'm encouraging those bishops who sit in the House of Lords, but also ordinary clergy and lay people, to really speak out against injustice.
Father Andrew Morton Mumby is the rector of St. Peter's Walworth in London. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
A pleasure.
Many of the new diseases that humans pick up come from animals. Think HIV, Ebola, SARS, and likely this new coronavirus. It probably came from an animal at a market in Wuhan, China. But live animals at city markets is only one risk of what scientists call disease spillover. Another risk has to do with changing habitats. The World's Environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, reports on the link between climate change and infectious diseases.
The more we come into contact with wild animals and their new viruses, the more we risk catching their diseases. This happens at markets like the one in Wuhan, but it also happens when we encroach on wildlife habitats.
As people move and wildlife move in response to a changing environment, humans and wildlife and animals will come in contact more regularly.
Jean Fair from the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico says that animal habitats will move due to climate change, and that will have a similar impact as deforestation, which has been linked to new disease outbreaks.
Everything is sort of shifting and will shift into the future as the environment changes through climate change.
Climate scientists and epidemiologists on FAIR's team are studying how changes to the climate will impact the animal carriers of infectious disease. It's early days still, but previous research suggests that drought has already contributed to at least one outbreak. It happened when bats moved out of rainforests and into orchards to find food.
We're going by the past data to really predict what's going to happen in the future. And so anytime you increase that wildlife-human interface, that's sort of an emerging disease hotspot. And so that's just increasing as we go forward into the future.
Much of the research linking climate change and infectious disease looks at the expansion of habitats for disease hosts, like bats. Gerardo Martin is a disease ecologist at Juarez University of the state of Durango. He found warmer temperatures might impact the transmission of the Hendra virus. It has killed 4 people after passing from bats to horses to humans in Australia back in 1994.
At least based on that study, we found that the black flying foxes...
Black flying foxes, a type of bat that carries the Hendra virus.
Might increasingly move southwards, which is a very widespread phenomenon that is occurring as a result of climate change.
Martin says warmer temperatures would allow bats to live farther south along Australia's coast, and that would bring them into contact with a lot more horses.
Climate change will increase the opportunities for Hendra virus spillover to horses, and that's how we infer that spillover to people might be more frequent.
Might, but not will. Martin says there are many variables in all of this, so whether more people will actually get Hendra virus in a warmer world?
That is a very difficult question to answer.
Experts say it's easier to answer questions about mosquito-borne illnesses. As temperatures warm, mosquito habitats will expand. The World Health Organization estimates that several hundred million more people could be at risk of getting malaria. Jeffrey Shaman of Columbia University says East African countries could see malaria zones expand not just out, but up.
Because there are places up the mountain slopes where there are villages and people living that don't have malaria simply because the temperatures are too cold for the malaria vectors to really go about their business and do anything. As it warms, those populations are going to be put at risk.
Shaman says we don't know yet whether climate change will cause a net increase in infectious disease rates globally, but it will make it harder for us to predict where those diseases will spread.
Because climate is one of the things that influences infectious diseases, if we disrupt their patterns of transmission, it is much more difficult for us to actually contend with it.
We'll have new outbreaks when and where we don't expect them, Shaman says, and none where we do.
And that disruption makes it much harder to keep people healthy because the resources are in the wrong place. And populations that have never had to contend with a certain disease are suddenly having to.
Texas State University geographer Yong Mei Lu says scientists need to map out how disease transmission might change in specific communities.
Everyone's talking about climate change, but what people in Central Texas need to do to be prepared is going to be different from what people in Central China or South China need to.
It's far too early to know how climate change may or may not impact this new coronavirus spreading around the globe. But Jean Fair from Los Alamos is so far impressed with the global health response to it.
It's been quite amazing to watch that, but this is going to be something that we'll need to get good at. because these will continue to keep happening.
How and where infectious diseases spread is going to change along with the climate, but we're only beginning to learn about it. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
How about climate awareness on the dance floor? That's one concept the Parisian artist Cerone has set to music.
I compose, produce, and perform my music for more than 40 years, close to 50 years. And the people can maybe remember Love in C minor and Supernature. The sound was really surprised a lot of people with Supernature. It was one of the first LP synthesizer LPs. And the lyrics also talk about the ecology. Our attitude are really, really, really bad. 43 years later, what we see with the world, Supernature was one of the witness who said, if we continue it like that, we're going to arrive in 2020 where we are. The name of my new album, it's DNA. So The Impact, that was the first song I composed for it. Also, I sampled the audio of one of the press conference of Jane Goodall, who explained very well how bad attitude we have on our planet.
Every single day we make some impact on the planet. We haven't inherited this planet from our parents. We've borrowed it from our children. If we get together, then we can start to heal some of the scars that we've inflicted.
It's for me a little bit the sweet of Supernature, not just in regard of the sound, in regard also of what we said, what we explained.
French music producer Cerone with his track Impact, along with some help from Jane Goodall. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.